I swear to God, computers, they just absolutely suck. All kinds of trouble getting started here, but I think we got it. I think we got it worked out. I can see the volumes are going haywire, though. See if I can't calm it down here just a tad. I'm not quite sure why that's going on like it is, but let me see if I can't fix that. I think Aaron finally made it back.
I did. Yep, I'm here.
All right. Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with that. I have no idea how this is even going to sound going out. Volumes were all whacked out of shape and everything. But, hey, you know, computers just suck sometimes.
True story. True story. Well, hopefully it turns out okay.
Well, and, you know, the funny thing about it is, I mean, when I'm done broadcasting, I turn everything off, shut everything down, and I go on about my business. Nothing changes. Until the next time, you know, we fire up. And it's just a hit or a miss, you know, where everything's going to start up correctly. And, you know, I guess it just depends on how you hold your tongue or something. I don't know. Anyway, we're back. I do have to say, our vacuum cleaner quit the other day. And so, I actually quit about a week and a half ago. And so, my wife wanted. Did I already tell you guys about this vacuum cleaner that we got?
I don't think so.
This is like.
No.
I'm still. Well, let me tell you what happened. Okay, so the vacuum cleaner quit, and you know, it's probably 20 years old, and so. You know, the wife, she wants to go out and get a new vacuum cleaner, no problem. She's going to go to Sears and you know, pick one up. I said, well, don't get one of those, you know, $99 deals. They just, you know, get a decent vacuum cleaner. And so she comes home with this box, and it's one of these funky thing with the big ball thing.
Oh,
yeah. So,
yeah.
Okay. Are you ready for this? She hands me the receipt for this vacuum cleaner. Now, mind you, this is something that gets used maybe once a week. Okay, and goes back into the closet and sits there quietly and does nothing but suck dirt from the carpet. Okay, $700.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. $700.
Well, you told her not to get the deal.
You think? I mean, holy cow. And I'm sitting there thinking, my God, that's like, I can buy 3 fermenters for that kind of money.
Yeah. Wow.
But this thing, I mean, you know. This $700 vacuum cleaner, I mean, it will suck the paint off the wall. I mean, it's the most powerful freaking vacuum cleaner I've ever seen in my life.
Pretty heavy.
You remember the old rainbows that you put water in, and when you vacuumed, all you had was a big pot of mud?
Yeah.
Oh, those were god-awful.
Yeah, when I was a kid, we used to have one that was attached to this, well, one of them pull-around canister deals that my mom had. And if you tug too hard on it, you know, the thing would, like, spring forward and hit you in the legs. And but, so anyway.
Something, were you, like, dragging part of it behind you as you go type of a thing?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So anyway, I get to vacuum. I mean, I'm the one that does all the vacuuming anyway. So now I get to drive this Porsche around the house that, you know, I mean, it's freaking unreal. But anyway, well, welcome to the Mead House. I think we got things already fixed here. Volumes are looking pretty good. We already got some listeners. Glad you're along for the ride. Jeff is not with us tonight. He's taking the night off. But I did get an email from him earlier. He, you know, we've been talking about braggarts and stuff, so we're going to share that here a little bit later on. I do have a few shout-outs to holler out of people. But in the meantime, again, welcome to the Mead House. We're live every Tuesday night right here at themeadhouse.com. You can get us on TuneIn Radio. You can also get the replays at themeadhouse.com. We're listed on Stitcher Radio, iTunes, and various places. And I think we might even be good to go on Google now. I have no idea. I haven't even looked. But Facebook, you can give us a holler on Facebook. Just simply go to The Mead House in your little search deal on the Facebook. We're not even going to do the Twitter thing. And if you get absolutely bored to death listening to the show and you really got to chime in and bring us back to the table, 818-921-4680, if you want to wake us all up, and we'll talk about anything that you want to talk about, so long as it's about Mead. Aaron Martin in the house, Mississippi Chris, is with us tonight, and I imagine we probably caught Chris at dinner time again, so I don't even know if I even want to ask him what he's drinking. Sweet tea, more than likely. Well, let's go ahead and start that off. Chris, tell me it's sweet tea.
It's not sweet tea.
I'll be damned.
It's a got a traditional sunflower blossom honey from Aaron.
Hmm.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh. Oh. You mean and our very own Aaron?
Our very own Aaron. It's one of his varietal experiments that he did. It needs a little age. Other than that, there's some good stuff happening in there.
Awesome.
Yep. Lots of good stuff. I'm drinking it at room temperature. Normally I drink meads a little bit chilled. So I think maybe some of the flavors that I'm tasting that I think maybe age would help probably wouldn't be there if it was where I normally drink it. So,
yeah,
so it's good stuff.
Well, I've heard, I think I ran across something, or maybe we talked about it on the show, where people are, I guess they're starting to drink mead at room temperature now for some reason. I guess they get more of the, like you say, the you know, the varietal characters and whatnot come out more more prevalent. So
yeah, if you've got an absolutely perfect mead, which is hard to do, room temperature is the way to go. But you know, we all have our flaws, and Lord knows everything I make has its flaws. So I stick it in the refrigerator, and it hides a lot of sins.
Yeah, you're going to be drinking mine ice cold.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, yeah, I guess my box from Aaron is supposed to arrive sometime this week. Apparently they had to stop and feed the horses. You know how Pony Express goes. But Aaron, what's in your glass tonight?
Well, tonight I am polishing off a bottle of Melovino's Tempted to Touch. This is Sergio's sweet mead that has the cocoa nibs and vanilla beans. Definitely a really fantastic mead. It kind of reminds me of his coffee mead that I tried, you know, maybe a month or two ago. Just a really nice, smooth base mead, and really like the coffee or the chocolate and vanilla flavors that are coming through as well.
Yeah, I remember that, you know, that batch that he sent us here a while back. I thought that was pretty good tasting stuff too myself. And I've absolutely given up on the coffee thing. I mean, you guys will be getting the coffee thing as soon as mine's done here in a few more weeks, hopefully, but.
So you're dumping it on us.
Oh yeah. I'm done with the coffee.
I think the Tempted to Touch was my favorite of all those he sent.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Well,
I've got one left. What was it, the Midnight Jack, I want to say, which is the one with, like, tart cherries and just some of those dark fruits going on. I've been saving that one for last, so definitely excited to crack that one open here.
God, you're a slow drinker. I finished mine a long time ago.
Yeah, I've been holding out, just saving them.
Well, I'm drinking a sweet mead tonight. This is a rabbit's foot meadery. I found this bottle at my BevMo here locally. And so I picked it up. I don't believe I've had some rabbit's foot mead, but I don't believe I've had their sweet mead. I don't quite know what to think of it yet. I need to drink some more, but it's definitely sweet. I mean, it absolutely smells like honey. I couldn't tell you what, and I don't have my other glasses on to see the label that clearly to know if they put the variety on there or not. But I mean, it's I'm drinking it ice cold. I mean, it's good cold. It is sweet. About a half a glass is all I'm going to be able to manage of this tonight. But it's fairly decent. If you're into sweet meads, this would make a fine little dessert after dinner type thing, I think. Just in case, I do have a bottle of Scuppernog sitting here. This is a wine, Muscadine wine from North Carolina that we brought back. So I thought, just in case I didn't like this rabbit's foot mead, why, I better put another bottle of something on the desk. So,
yeah, there you go.
I did manage to get around today and... kind of a busy day here. Spent doing some household chores here. And I don't know where you live, but where I live, it's been like in the hundreds again. And so wandering outside, I just don't do that. I just try to stay inside. So keeping myself busy doing the manly house chores that I do every week. So, I did manage to get around in between driving the vacuum from room to room to the Facebook deal. I want to throw a shout out to Patricia Gwen Edwards. This comes from the Mead Makers Facebook group. She's into doing braggots too. She's got one going now, and she's doing, I don't think it says what yeast she's using. She's using some kind of an ale yeast in this thing. It's 51% honey, apparently. And it's she calls it a French honey beer, farmhouse ale. She doesn't really go into a list of the ingredients, but I just wanted to throw her a shout out. We've been kind of communicating. She's an avid listener, and she can't listen live apparently, but she always listens the day after the show. So she'll be listening tomorrow, and she's very much into doing braggots. So in this particular one she's doing is getting ready, I guess, for a competition that she intends to enter with it. So wishing Patricia Gwen Edwards lots of luck there. Let us know how it turns out, and keep us informed here on the show. And we'd be glad to let everybody know how you did. Last week I mentioned, it might have even been a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that I was doing this peach mead, and I think we might have talked about it on the show. I caught up with William Francis. Now, I'm probably going to butcher your last name, William, but I'm going to call it Reed, W-R-E-D-E. This is, I believe it was on Mead Makers, if I'm not mistaken. I forgot to put the, it might have been Wine Enthusiast, come to think of it, but Mead and Wine Enthusiast, I believe. But anyway, William Francis Reed, he started a peach also, and he's also using wildflower, but he's doing his quite a bit different than I did. he's putting 15 pounds of peaches in primary and looks like 15 in secondary, and adding some vanilla bean and some lemon zest in secondary. Now, he blanched his peaches and peeled them, and he's only using half the skins in secondary. So I thought that was a pretty unique way to make a peach mead as well. So good luck with your mead there, William. Let us know how it turns out. Anxious to hear about it. And, if you're able, call us on the show, or we'd be glad to have you on Skype or whatever, however we can get you on the show. But would like for you to come in and talk about your peach mead if you can. He's using 71B yeast, by the way. So, that out of the way, my peach mead so far, well, we'll save that for the hopper list later on in the show. No new developments, really, but it's coming along. But we'll talk about it here a little bit later on. I was so busy doing stuff today, and I really didn't even feel like getting that involved with the show, because I wanted this to be off the cuff, open forum, free for all night. So I put very little in the show notes. I did want to talk a little bit more about the braggots, though, Aaron. I don't know if you saw that recipe that that Jeff had sent us.
I sure did.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
You know, it looks like a really tasty one to me. So this is a recipe that Jeff sent out, and it's based off of a Saison beer style, which is a little bit lighter bodied, lighter colored type of a beer style with some kind of like estuary notes that you get from the yeast. And it's a really solid beer style. Definitely this time of year, JD, you're talking about the 100 degree temperatures out there. I think a Saison would be a good one to cool you off out there. Yeah. So let me see if I can get this pulled up here to take a look at what he has going on. So he's got 5 pounds of a light dried malt extract, 1 pound of a Belgian Pilsner malt, 1 pound of a white wheat malt. I'm thinking that those may be what he's going to be using as his specialty grains to kind of steep a little bit before he adds in the malt extract. Then roughly 8 pounds of honey, enough to get you up to, what does he say, a starting gravity of, I want to say it was like a 1.09 or 1.092 type of a range. And then he has like a French Saison yeast, the Y yeast 3711. So looks like a definitely an interesting recipe. Oh, and then lastly, he's got some Mosaic hops as well, which I was doing a little bit of research about before the show. Definitely that sounds like a pretty interesting hop to me. I've not used Mosaic hops before, but looking at some of the descriptors here, you know, it looks like a nice dual purpose hop that maybe you could use for some bittering as well as, you know, flavor or aroma. And just some really interesting like citrus, pine, herbs, mint, blueberry, like all different kinds of flavors that you can get from this hop, kind of depending on how you use it. So definitely an intriguing recipe that he's got put together here.
Yeah, and we're gonna put this up on the website. Now, he says that this is an off-the-cuff, something that he put together. He's never done this before, so
untested.
You know, yep. If there are any expectations out, just set that aside, because he has no idea how this is going to turn out. But I mean, looking over this recipe, Chris, I think you got the recipe too. If you haven't had
it, I was just looking over it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see anything here that's really that far out of line. Of course, not knowing a whole lot about making beer, but. What's your thought?
Well, you're doing a mash, steeping the grains. Then you strain that off and you put it into your bowl. And, you know, my limited knowledge of beer brewing, that's pretty much how it's done.
Yeah.
And when I say limited, I stress limited. So it's looking like he's doing he's not using an extract or anything. It's all grain brewing here, pretty much.
Well, you're using a dry malt extract. That's going to be in powder form, right, Aaron? That's
yeah, he's going to.
Correct.
But he is still doing a mash, though, with the grains, yeah. I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Now he's also included all the steps. You know, I mean, he's methodically planned this out, which is good. You know, he takes you all the way through the boil and everything. I don't want to again go into all of the you know, complete specifics. We'll put this up on the website and on the Facebook page, but. I'm not seeing anything here. I don't know what mosaic. Can you speak to the mosaic hops, Aaron, at all?
Yeah, so the mosaic hops, looking at the bitterness level, they look like they're definitely on the high level in terms of the alpha acids. And as I think Jeff alluded to last week, the alpha acid is kind of the typical measuring stick for hops to determine, you know, how intense of a bitterness or how intense of a bittering character you're going to get. So to give a little bit of a scale here, you know, hops that are between the 3-7% range are going to be in kind of that low to medium bitterness range. 8-12 and above is going to be kind of that medium to high bitterness. And the mosaic, it just says on this website I'm looking at, over 10%. So definitely high on the bitterness level, which would probably make it a good candidate for the bittering hop, which, you know, you would incorporate for the full 60 minutes of the boil. And that's not to say you couldn't add some, you know, towards the end of the boil as well to give you some of the flavor and aroma characteristics as well, which might be really nice. Just to, again, reading through some of the descriptors, the flavor descriptors of this hop, you know, things like citrus and pine, earthy, herbal, mint, bubblegum, blueberry, you know, some of these types of flavors, just a lot of different types of flavors going on with this hop. I haven't personally had any experience with the mosaic hop, but after reading a little bit about it, it definitely looks like an interesting one to experiment with.
Yeah. Yeah, and he
talk a little bit about the esters from that sawn yeast. Also, that's from what I've heard, that's a very interesting profile that comes from that type of yeast.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think with the saison yeast, you're going to get maybe some spicy or peppery, even like an earthy type of flavor that the yeast will put off. One of the other things that was interesting reading his recipe is that even at warmer temperatures, you know, greater than 75 degrees, you can get some of those esters that are favorable and kind of desirable characteristics that you would want, especially with this style. You know, saisons definitely have just a very distinct bite to them. For anyone that's ever had one, you know, it's definitely a very distinctive
one. Isn't that what's sort of known as the farmhouse style?
Yep, beer? I think I have heard it described that way.
Yeah, I think so.
Farmhouse ale,
yeah. I'm drinking this mead from Aaron, and it's got a beer quality to it. It's not strong, but it's got some kind of a beer quality.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know where that's coming from. No, it's not carbonated. It's got a beer-like quality to it. Sort of the more you drink it. Maybe it's because it's drier than what I'm used to.
You know, as I recall the whole process I went through with these honey varietals, I actually started out with an ale yeast, the Cefail US05, and pretty much had a failure to launch there. So repitched with the D47, and after that, it just took off like a rocket. But some of them, I remember the cranberry one was at least very sluggishly starting to go when I added the D47. I think the sunflower just was sitting there not doing much of anything. But I wonder if that has anything to do with some of the beer characteristics that you're getting there.
I think Jeff's onto something here. This really looks like something that is worthy of trying. I know he said he was getting a little bored and didn't have anything started, and I think I kind of alluded to that last week, and in one of the emails that I got from him, he said that he just couldn't stand it anymore. He had to get something going, so too many empty fermenters, I guess, so... but this sounds like a something doable. You know, he's got this one tablespoon of teaspoon of Irish moss, and I had forgotten what that was, trying to think of what kind of flavor does that give, but then I was reminded that that is a clearing agent, actually.
Yeah.
Does the same thing as those, I think they call it whirl flock tablets that go in. So that's really a no-brainer. I mean, I suppose you could use that in place of Irish moss if you couldn't get your hands on Irish moss. But this looks pretty good. I would be anxious to try this one out and see how it does. You know, we were talking last show about, you know, starting to get into beers and braggots and mixing the two, mead and beer, and talking about, all the different ingredients. I suppose, I mean, if you wanted to stay, and this is the one thing that I really, this whole thing, is the fact that you don't have to stay within the confines of the style itself. Now, if you're going to submit your mead for competition, then you pretty much got to stick to, you know, the rules surrounding each one of those styles. But who's to say, Just Recipe, why couldn't you up the DME, lower the honey, so you don't have 50% honey, Who's to say
you want to take it more to the beer side or more to the mead side?
Well, you know, I'm thinking from my own personal preference, I'm thinking more to the beer side. I want something more beer-like, but I want some of the characters of mead, to be... we talked about, coming up with a beer recipe. I mean, if I got a beer kit from Northern Brewer or More Beer or whatever, and just for the hell of it, threw in a couple of quarts of honey, come off the boil, add a couple of quarts of honey to it, it's going to take the gravity up, a couple of notches. But at that point, I mean, who really cares at that point? Just to see, what the outcome would be. Now, I'm not, not trying to qualify this as a braggot by any stretch of the matter. But, it's just the addition of honey to a beer recipe. Just to, I've read about people, guys who brew beer adding honey in during fermentation. So I'm just curious.
You know what? Everyone knows I'm a Melomel guy.
Yeah.
So, and I've already said that my knowledge of braggots is close to zero. So when I start thinking about that, I naturally take my scientific approach and I start drawing on what I do know, which is Melomels, and knowing how important balance is. Mm-hmm. Also knowing how certain flavors can overpower certain honeys very easily. So when I start thinking about making a braggot, the first thing I think about is, naturally, how much honey am I going to put in? And since I don't know, then I would start looking toward things like the flavors that the malt is going to give it. How strong are they? What is the overall style of the beer base? How strong are the hops? How bitter are the hops? And how strong is the honey? So then I start thinking about how do I bring all this into balance so that the honey, do I want to taste honey? If I want to taste honey, then I have to consider all this stuff and think, is there something here that's going to completely overpower it? So, you know, then I start digging into it and I get confused and I give up and I never make a braggot. So, but I guess the time has come to figure it all out. And, so anything that I say about braggots, if you're listening, don't take my word as gospel because it's far from it.
Yeah, well, me too. I mean, this whole beer brewing experience for me is, you know, I mean, I've just got that one under my belt so far. And, I mean, as much as I would call it a success, I'm not 100% pleased with it. I think I can do better. And I think that just comes down to fine-tuning some of the ingredients, leaving some out, like pumpkin. I mean, pumpkin, I really don't see the point in pumpkin. I really don't. And I would even go so far as saying, you know what, if you're making a pumpkin mead, leave the pumpkin out. Just use the pumpkin pie spices because that's actually what you taste. The pumpkin did absolutely nothing for the beer at all as far as flavor goes. It just added a degree of creaminess almost to the taste. And I'm sure that would probably, might even be the same for the mead too, I suppose, but.
I think there's probably some saccharides and things in there that are being released that are going to add to mouthfeel and creaminess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's probably something that you may not realize is there until it's not there.
Well, and this is, you know, this goes back to tasting the ingredients. Now, I try to make it a habit to taste everything that goes in. I want to know, you know, what it's going to taste like. You know, for instance, the malt, I stuck my finger in the empty bag of malt and you know, took a couple of licks. And that's about all you'd want to do. I mean, you wouldn't want to, I wouldn't put a spoonful in your mouth.
Not quite as pleasant as honey.
No. No. It does have a sweetness.
But better than hops.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. But
yeah, I made that same mistake also that we were talking about last week. I've done that before.
Yeah, take it from us, even though we're not beer experts, don't chew on hops. That's just not, you really don't want to do that.
That's not what you do.
Yeah, I would have a pocket full of Rolaids if you think you want to do something like that handy, but so this braggot beer thing, you know, again, I mean, tasting the ingredients, I think it's a pretty important aspect. The one thing I like about this recipe is he's using all these light, almost like a Pilsner lager type, beer almost, white wheat malt, Belgian Pilsner. I've had Belgian Pilsners here. I like them. I like Pilsners in general. I like lagers in general. So, and then he's using this, 5 pounds of light malt extract. So I can see this is going to be kind of a light-colored mead. But I guess that... Yeah. I guess it all kind of boils down to the hops, too. Now, he's got them split up into 2 1-ounce additions, one at, I want to say 40 minutes. I'm looking. Yeah, one at, looks like one at 40 minutes, and then one at...
One and another one after 40 minutes and boiling for the remaining 20?
Yeah, there you go. We got one at 40 minutes and one at 20 minutes, or at 20 yeah. minutes later. So
so that's 40 minutes left on the boil and 20 minutes left on the boil.
Yeah.
Or is it the other way around? So the first ounce would go in for 40 minutes, and then the second one would go in for the remaining 20. So the first ounce boils for
the inverse. If you take the inverse of the multiple,
and then the carry the zero,
yes, and the reverse average,
Jeff, yes,
the remainder.
If you're yeah. listening, Jeff, call the show or send me a quick email, will you?
We need help.
I see this on other people's recipes too. Add this at, you know, at 40 minutes, add this. Okay, is that 40 minutes in or is that 40 minutes left, you know?
I got a game plan. I say we let Jeff make it and send us all bottles of it.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's the easy way to do it. And then if we like it, we can order more from him.
There you go.
There you go.
It's, you know, yeah, because we talked about on the last show that we were going to do 3 different braggots. We were just going to go ahead and order kits from, you know, whatever source, beer kits, and then do our honey addition to it. Let's talk about that for a minute. So if we get one of these beer kits, typically it's, you know, coming with a specific gravity in mind, give or take a few points. So are we talking about on top of the malt extract adding the honey, or are we talking about taking however many poundage? If it comes out to 3 pounds if it comes out to 6 pounds of malt, you know, either dry or liquid malt extract, and we want to put 3 pounds of honey in. Do we take 3 pounds of malt extract out and replace that with the honey? Is that how we're working this? Or
I'd say no. I'd say pile it in on top of it.
Put it in on top. Get the gravity. I'll take the gravity.
Yeah, if you lose your DME, you're losing a lot of your beer quality.
True.
Yeah. So I say kick the gravity on up and let's kick it through the roof and do it right.
Okay.
The only thing I would...
Let's make some alcohol.
They drink a lot in Mississippi, don't they?
They do.
Nothing else to do on a hot day. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, no, the only thing I was going to say is... you know, I noticed, so Jeff's recipe calls out for this, you know, why yeast? It's an ale yeast. And with a lot of ale yeasts, once you get up above a certain gravity, just pitching in directly like a smack pack or I know I've used like the White Labs vials of liquid yeast. You know, when you start getting above those certain gravity levels, the ale yeasts don't always handle that very well. And one of the recommendations for really improving the quality of your homebrewed beer, especially for higher gravity beers, would be to make a yeast starter where essentially, you know, you start off with maybe some boiled malt extract, you add some yeast in and kind of build that colony of yeast up prior to pitching it into your wort. So in that case where, you know, rather than just replacing half of your malt extract with honey,
and having a lower gravity, if we're going to go down this road of increasing that starting gravity up, which I'm all for, by the way, it may be worthwhile to have a yeast starter.
Mm-hmm. And two other options as well. The second option would be to pick a yeast that fits in the style we're doing but will handle a higher gravity. And the other option would be step feeding.
True.
Step feeding the yeast?
No, step feeding the honey in. We could, instead of putting all the honey in up front, we could just let it get a good start and step feed up. So
after a few days, throw in some honey.
Yeah.
Well, and then even another option.
If we were going to use 8 pounds, we could put, say, 3 pounds in to start, and once the gravity drops, put another couple of pounds in, and do it that way.
Very true.
We're not talking. We're not talking 20 pounds of honey here, obviously, because I don't want this to come out more on the sweet side. I want this to come out more on the dry side, more beer-like. How much are we talking, honey versus malt extract?
The one bracket that I did make, the Red Irish Ale, was 6 pounds of DME and... I think it was 8 pounds of honey.
Okay.
That
was a 5-gallon batch?
That was a 5-gallon batch. Yep.
Okay.
So I'd have to look back on it. I'm almost certain it was 8 pounds of honey. I know for a fact it was 6 pounds of DME.
So you were probably at 0.97, not even that high, probably
0.97.
Yeah, but before you put the honey in, you're probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.55, 0.57, somewhere in there?
Probably so, yeah. I'd have to look at my logbook. I've got it written down.
And then 8 pounds of honey on top of that, I mean, I guess probably 100, maybe not even that, maybe.
I think it was about 1092 or something like that was the starting.
You think that's too high for an 05 or an 04, Aaron?
What was that again? You said it was
1.092.
1 point. It's maybe just right in that range. Do you know what yeast you used?
I used the Red Irish Ale yeast.
And that seemed to work out okay?
Yeah, I think the one I used was maybe the White Labs. No, I used the Y-Yeast Smack Pack, I think.
Okay.
The Irish Ale.
Irish Ale.
Let me just get my book and I'll tell you.
There you go. I'm all for using an ale yeast, a regular beer yeast, ale yeast. So,
let's see. Let me find it here. I've got my logbook. That was a long time ago, guys.
I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay, I used White Labs Irish Ale yeast.
Okay.
Yeah. So that would be the one that comes in the little vial, little test tube.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I used on that one. 6 pounds of DME. I used 6 pounds of dark DME. I used 8 pounds of blackberry blossom honey. And I used... Now, I split my notes up here for some reason. Why in the hell did I do that? This is why you need to be organized, people.
Well,
okay, I used 1.5 ounces of pellet Chinook hops at 60 minutes left, right at the beginning. That gave 50 IBUs. I used 1/2 ounce of Chinook hop pellets with 20 minutes left on the boil. That gave another 10 IBUs. And then at the end, with 5 minutes left on the boil, I put in 2.1 ounces of East Kent Golding pellet hops.
Okay.
And, well, here I've got marked out. Okay, I used 10 pounds of blackberry honey. I marked out 8 and put 10. So I used 2 3-pound bags of dark DME, 10 pounds of blackberry blossom honey. I did a 3-gallon boil volume with 65 total IBUs of Chinook and East Kent Goldings and Irish ale yeast, White Labs. I fermented in a bucket at approximately 70 degrees, and I keg carbonated. I have some notes here that say you can either use Chinook or Eroica hops for the first two additions, and then if you don't want to use the East Kent Goldings, you can use either Cascade or Centennial with 5 minutes left on the boil. So I had some options written down here. 3-gallon boil made it up to a 5.5-gallon batch size, which got racked into a 5-gallon carboy. Yep. So gravity. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask what your gravity numbers were.
Yeah, the original gravity with the dry malt extract only was 1048.
Okay.
And then after the honey addition, I've got 1098.
Okay.
So I was sitting at 1098, and my final gravity turned out to be 1.013.
Okay. Interesting.
So it really chewed through some of those sugars.
Yeah, it ended up, and I kegged it, put it in a corny keg and force carbed it to, let's see, what did I do here? 3 volumes, I think. Yeah, I carved it to 3 volumes.
Yeah.
So, turned out pretty good for my first one.
Yeah. Well, you've got that under your belt. Go over your hops again. Why was there a particular reason why you changed, or why you decided on that particular hops that you used? Or
because Ken Schramm said to do it.
Oh.
Ken Schramm told me to.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the truth. That's what he said. For the first two editions, the first edition is at 60 minutes, and that was 1.5 ounces of Chinook pellets. You could also use Eroica hops there. And you're shooting for 50 IBUs. So there's this little chart that you can look up, and some kind of little formula that I looked up to convert IBUs to figure out how many ounces. and it came out to 1.5 ounces of pellets, or 1.7 ounces if you're using whole leaf hops. And that's it. That's at the very beginning of the boil. And that's for Chinook. Now, I added another half ounce of pellets of Chinook with 20 minutes left on the boil. And that was for, that added another 10 IBUs. And then when there was 5 minutes left on the boil, I added 2.1 ounces of East Kent Golding pellets.
Okay.
And that was it. So your options here for hops are, if you don't want to use the Chinook for the first two additions, you can use Eroica. For that last addition at 5 minutes, you can use East Kent Goldings, you can use Cascade or Centennial.
Yeah.
And that's it. So you boil that for 60 minutes with those additions with 6 pounds of dark DME. Then as it begins to cool down some, start dissolving in 10 pounds of blackberry blossom honey after the boil. And then you cool it down and add, put it in your fermenter and add the water up to 5.5 gallons.
Yeah.
And then you ferment with White Labs Irish Ale yeast around 70 degrees. And once it's finished, rack it, let it clear, and then force carb it.
And you had, you said you used blackberry honey, right?
Blackberry blossom honey, yeah.
Yeah. Was there any, what did that add to the final product? Or could you tell?
I don't know, because you're asking me about something I made like 4 years ago. So.
Okay. All right.
There's been a lot of alcohol consumed since then.
Both homemade and other, right?
Yeah, of all sorts and a lot of different flavors. I could not tell you because I don't have any tasting notes written down. But I do remember, because it was the only Braggot that I ever made, I do remember being very pleased that it came out as well as it did.
It sounds like something that you would do again then, for sure.
Yes, and you have to remember, this was done at a time when I did not really realize the importance of temperature control and all this kind of stuff. So, and I didn't have my nutrient schedules fine-tuned like I do now. So with those two factors alone, I think I could make this much better now than I did then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd make it again.
Well, I think the next step for me, I think what I would have to do, guys, is go through all the different hop varieties and, you know, figure out, if I can discern, you know, what they add, what kind of flavors they add, to the batch, you know,
Definitely.
Even after making this pumpkin thing, I mean, you know, I put the Cascade hops in. I think one was immediate, right at the beginning of the boil. The other one was the last 5 minutes, I believe. An ounce and a half up front, a half an ounce in the end. I have no clue. I mean, I understand the hops and the flavor of hops and how they contribute to beer, but I don't particularly get the final addition of hops. I mean, they say that's for aroma. Well, I don't go around with my nose stuck to my beer bottle sniffing my beer, so I really don't care what it smells like. I'm just wondering what purpose that serves, actually.
Well, when you're dealing with a carbonated beverage, and especially if you're drinking it from a mug, you're going to have a lot more influence from aroma than you would with a still beverage.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. So you're picking up a lot more aroma from beer than you would from, say, a wine or a mead.
Well, and yeah, things do take, you know, it's funny how your sensories work. I mean, things do taste better when you can smell them, you know?
Mm-hmm. And they can influence your perception of it, too. Like in this instance, these East Kent Goldings, they give sort of an English ale character to it. So some people might refer to this as an English ale braggot. I called it an Irish ale because I used an Irish ale yeast. But with these East Kent Goldings, it you might even call it an English ale, which is quite a bit different. So, yeah, they can influence for sure, those last additions.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, JD is... one of the things I did to, you know, prepare and do a little homework for some of our discussions about beer, I was looking at some pretty commonly used hop varieties and just kind of taking some notes on them to see what is that alpha acid percentage. And what I've noticed is that in general, it seems like those, and this definitely stands to reason, the hops that have the higher levels of alpha percentage, so, you know, like Jeff, or Chris mentioned, he used the Chinook hops as the bittering hop. You know, the ones that have the higher levels tend to be used as the bittering hops, which are boiled for the full 60 minutes. Some of the other hops that are more in like that medium to low alpha acid percentage range are typically used more as the flavor and aroma hops. Now, it's, you know, certainly not to say that you can't have certain hops that are more of like a dual purpose and can be used as both bittering and flavor and aroma as well, but just kind of an interesting trend that I'm seeing, at least in these maybe 10 or 12 hop varieties that I was looking at.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'm actually thinking of something dark. I don't know. I've got this dark braggot in mind. You know, using a dark malt extract instead of a light malt extract, going almost to the complete opposite direction that Jeff was going with his. But
you know, I think like a chocolate porter or a chocolate stout.
That's what I'm thinking.
Make a good one.
Yeah, that's kind of
my wife likes those Guinness.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of them, but she likes them. I'm thinking something like, you know, toward that direction anyway. Because you get that creaminess, and that creaminess is really going to come into play when it starts to interact with the honey.
See, that's where I could take the creaminess in a beer or whatever you want to call this we're putting together, more so than that pumpkin. In that pumpkin, it's just. I don't know. It doesn't taste right. That creaminess just really, it almost takes away from the overall flavor of the beer, as far as I'm concerned. But
yeah,
in something like a chocolate porter braggot thing we're talking about here, I could see where that would really play into a nice finish. Actually.
Yeah, playing with the chocolate and the honey, and then, you know, the natural creaminess that's going to be there. And then if you want to add even more, you can carb it with nitrogen instead of CO2. And that'll get an even more real fine, creamy head on it. So.
Oh, yeah. Nitrogenated beers are so smooth.
They are. It's like night and day difference. And it's worth the extra trouble.
How do you come by one of those, I wonder?
You just use a nitrogen tank instead of CO2.
Well, I'm not set up to do that, but can you buy that kind of stuff can you buy a nitrogen carb beer at a liquor store?
You can. I think Sam Adams right now has some different styles of beer that they're putting out that are nitrogenated. I want to say they've got like an IPA and some different things like that, so that might be something to look for.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check with my guy down at BevMo and see. Because that's the other, besides the $700 vacuum cleaner, I'm faced with another dilemma too, I've been toying around with the idea of getting another fermenter, but this is going to be like the mother of all fermenters in my collection. So I'm looking at a 14-gallon job, and that's going to be a hard sell. Apparently it's, probably going to be a lot harder than the $700 vacuum cleaner, but it's either that or, and I've also been toying around with the idea of a kegerator, and I have compared the cost of just getting a small refrigerator and doing a conversion, and honestly it's almost cheaper just to go out and buy a damn kegerator and with all the stuff. Minus the pony kegs, but those are a dime a dozen, pretty much. I can pick those up, fairly cheaply at two of my homebrew places. So, I'm not sure which direction I want to go with it yet, because I really do want to get into this beer making, braggot making thing. And I need one fermenter to do that in. I really need something to do beer in.
I'd skip the fermenter and invest some money in your kegging setup.
Yeah.
And get you a good beer gun. Get you a Blickman beer gun, and get set up to do that correctly, because. Yeah. When you get into it, you're going to start getting into these styles, especially with braggots, where you're going to have residual sweetness left. And the only way you're going to be able to do it is to force carb them. So you're going to need that. And I've got some really good recipes for some hydromels that are force carbed. And the only way to do it is to have that little setup. And then you'll spend less money, actually, than you would on that fermenter.
Well, you're right. Besides that, the kegerator setup is something that my wife will actually say yes to. Because I swear, if she comes home and finds this giant fermenter sitting next to the twins, I might as well just lock myself in the bedroom for the next month or two.
Someone's going to be in the doghouse.
Oh, yeah.
But if got a good cold spigot to pour out a good cold beer out of,
yep.
She's going to be happy.
Oh, yeah. See, she loves her beer. She loves her Arrogant Bastard beers. She loves her Guinness. She loves Tans. She loves her beer. So that's an easy sell. Honey, look, we can make our own beer and have it right here on tap. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So, JD, what you need to do is get the kegging system, get some nice draft beer, and
in her, and then she won't care if you get the 14-gallon fermenter after that.
Yeah, but when she wakes up, there'll be hell to play. So,
yeah. It's easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So,
true story.
Yeah, so, I mean, the twins, I mean, I told her that I was, you know, going to invest in some winemaking equipment, and she kind of threw her eyeballs up into her head, and, you know, one of those moves, and I thought, okay, that means yes, right? So I bought the first fermenter, and then I said, honey, this, you know, one is just not enough. I got to have two. And so the second one was, you know, that was okay too. But the third, I'm really pushing the limit here. So besides that, man, and the 14-gallon job was actually more. It was going to be dual purpose because, you know, I kind of wanted to do what Chris does, get more into these melomels and stuff. And my first experience with, you know, putting raw product into a meat didn't go well, and that was that pumpkin thing. You know, the displacement of 27 pounds of pumpkin just, you know, it just doesn't work in a 7-gallon fermenter. So,
yeah, but here's JD, you know, I have to go through the same thing you do. I have to justify, but more so, you know, I'm a tightwad. I'm a miser. So I justify to myself these purchases. I don't justify them to my wife or someone else. I have to talk myself into them. Okay? So when I start trying to justify it, I look at my setup that I have, and I look at my 5-gallon plastic bucket from Home Depot, and I look at my 15-gallon trash can from Home Depot, food grade.
Yeah.
And I think I'm making really good mead right now with this. Why do I need that? And so I don't buy it. So
I thought you were going to go the other way and think, oh, gee, God, you poor slob using all this secondhand stuff to make. You could be using stainless steel and.
Well, see, but being a miser like I am, I go the other way. Yeah. I think I can go spend another $21 to get another 15-gallon trash can, food grade, and I'm all set. I've got another 15-gallon batch going. So yeah, I kind of go the other way because I'm so stingy, and I don't like spending money. I don't get pleasure out of spending money. So when there's a cheaper way, you know, you can bet I'm going to do it. That's just how I am. It's ingrained in me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I could go out and buy 10 stainless steel fermenters today and have them delivered on a flatbed truck and set up a. I couldn't sleep at night if I did that.
Remind me never to go to him for bypass surgery because I might wind up with rubber hose from an auto shop in my chest.
No, fuel line works really well. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking about suggesting fuel line to the FDA and see if I could get a trial started on that.
Oh, my God. Oh, Christ.
But seriously,
wow.
You know, I'm talking more for the people listening out there who may be thinking, what do I have to make good mead, to make good braggots, to make good whatever?
Yeah.
You need a food-grade plastic container. You do not have to go out and buy stainless steel fermenters. Now, if you like shiny new things and you like having all the gizmos, if that makes you happy, then by all means do it. I am not trying to talk you out of it. I'm just saying, somewhere down the line, if you're tight on funds, you're going to run into things that you really and truly do need. So for those people listening who say, I've got X amount of money to spend on this, don't spend it on expensive fermenters and then later on realize I need a kegging setup and I can't afford it. So go the cheap route with the things that work just fine, like the food grade buckets, and then spend your money on a good kegging setup, on a good counter pressure filler of some kind, like a Blickman beer gun or something. Spend your money where it counts. If you're on a budget, because you can definitely make really good mead, wine, braggots, beer, whatever in a food grade bucket. Well, I better say beer because I don't know about beer, but the others you can for sure.
Well, beer, I mean, you know, it's a common practice to ferment beer in these plastic wide mouth, what do they call them, big mouth bubblers or whatever that you see that are so common, but, you know, even to keep them in secondary for, you know, a month is not that big a deal. What you don't want to do wine or a mead for, you know, a year and a half or a year in them, that just, you know, that's not a good idea. But beer making, I mean, you're, you know, within a couple of months it's going to be in a bottle or a keg, so you know, if even that, probably not even a couple of months, you're probably looking at maybe 6 to 8 weeks maybe. So,
well, speaking of aging, I don't mean to change the subject here, but I got an email.
It's free for all night, so it changes.
Free for all night, okay. Yeah. So I got an email. You remember Patty Mackey, who had called in, and she emailed me asking me about this cherry melomel. I had sent her the recipe, and she was going to make it, and so she emailed me, and she was asking about how important is the temperature once primary is over. So we're going into secondary.
Yeah.
And I assumed that she meant maybe from secondary onward, even through aging. And the way that I answered her is that I don't think temperature is quite as important once active fermentation is over. I am not saying that it's not important. I think probably cellar temperatures are ideal, but it's honestly not feasible for me to do that, and probably the majority of home brewers, it's not something that they can do very easily. So I wanted to throw that out there and get you guys' opinion on that, and anyone listening that wants to call and give their opinion. When it comes to mead, now we're not talking about wine or beer, we're talking about mead.
Yeah.
How important do you feel temperature control is after primary?
Almost, actually I think it's very important. And this is something that I picked up from producing that other show. Of course, we had Pete Bocklich, the Ask Oscar session, and this question came up at least a few times that I know of. And his response was that, you know, temperature control is important all the way through, because the one thing that lower temperatures in aging does is help clear the wine. Higher temperatures will just delay that for a period. Higher temperatures can also have an effect on the flavor as well, apparently. So cooler temperatures, if you can maintain a steady, not cool, I mean, we're not talking, you know, something, you know, 50 degrees or colder, but, you know, we're talking probably in the neighborhood of 65 degrees or cooler. It's the same thing as keeping wine, you know, in a cool environment. So, but that's
okay.
That's
with that said, though, do you have the ability to keep yours at that temperature all the way through the aging process? Because I don't.
Yes, I do.
You do. Okay.
Yes.
Well.
Yeah. this is going back to the DIY setup that handles all of my chilling needs, basically. I have, now this only works if you are your design is set up to handle, okay? I have two immersion chillers, I can run two fermenters, and cool two carboys, external carboys, at the same time, and not change ice but once every 5 days. So the two carboys are encompassed with, or encircled with, 80 feet of 3/8-inch copper tubing. And they make contact with the carboy. And then around that is an insulated jacket that wraps around. It keeps the copper nice and snug close to the carboy. These are glass carboys, mind you, not plastic. Glass, which is a good conductor of heat and cool. And then there's with a thermal well that goes down inside. And both of them are hooked up to a digital controller. And when the internal temperature reaches a certain degree, it turns the pump on and chills the carboy. Now, I have the capability of chilling both carboys to 55 degrees and keep it there constantly. But at that temperature, I'm changing ice about every 3 days. So I do have the ability to chill. I keep my aging carboys are kept at 65 degrees, no matter what the internal, what the ambient temperature is in the house. They're kept at 65 degrees. So.
Okay, well, 65 degrees is about the ambient temperature in my house all the time because I don't like it hot. I like to stay cool. Yeah. I do my best work when it's cool. I mean, for God's sake, I work in an OR, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know how cold those are, by God.
I don't like it hot, so I keep the thermostat cranked way down. So my ambient temperature is 65, 67.
You're good. You're fine.
Yeah. So when I do my primary, I really keep those temperatures down in the low end of whatever yeast I'm using, and normally it's 71B, but I keep them down toward the low end, but once primary is over, they go to room temperature, and I don't worry about them anymore. Now, Patty and I were discussing this, and we both have noticed something. Being a Melomel guy, I tend to follow a lot of what Ken Schramm does because he's big on the Melomels as well. And she and I both had noticed that if you go in his place, his bar, there's just carboys sitting everywhere with mead aging in them, and they're just sitting there at ambient temperature. So it's pretty obvious that he's not doing a lot of temperature control after primary either. So that kind of told me, well, it's okay. Because I don't think there's anybody that's going to say that Ken's not making some good mead. So,
I don't think after primary, I don't think temperature really has that big of an effect. And I'm not saying that you can't store mead at a higher temperature. I think what Oscar Pete was alluding to was the cooler, the better.
I certainly agree. I think cellar temperatures are ideal, but I don't think it's something to stress over if you can't maintain that all the time.
No, not at all. Aaron, what's your take on it?
Well, I'll tell you, even once it's in the bottle, I can be a little bit of a fanatic about it too. When we do traveling or we go visit people, or even if we're just on vacation and we're transporting bottles of mead, you can ask my wife about it and she just loves me for this. You know, if there's luggage and the dog and a cooler and all this stuff that needs to fit in the car, you would she would probably prefer the mead go in the trunk, but like I say, I'm just kind of a fanatic about it, and like that's going in the car, in the air conditioning to keep it at a nice temperature. So I definitely think there's something to it. I try to keep my meads when they're aging down in the basement at, you know, 65 degrees room temperature, and I think that's definitely a good practice as well.
Yeah,
that's difficult to do in Mississippi. The you can count on one hand the number of basements in Mississippi.
You can go to someplace like Total Wine or a BevMo where they've got hundreds of thousands of bottles of wine sitting on the shelf. And the ambient temperature inside, you know, these places is probably 75 degrees, being the, you know, power, you know, conserving power and whatnot. And it's going to be between, say, 72 and 75 degrees inside some of these places. And this wine, you know, some of this wine sits on the shelves for months and months and months. So, and I think wine is probably more susceptible to temperature changes than probably mead would be, too. I don't know that for a fact, but I know
I think you're right. I think we're talking about different animals. And, of course, when you get into melomels, you may be stepping over that line a little bit further. But my final answer to it is, if you can keep it cooler, keep it cooler. If you can't, don't stress over it.
Yeah.
Because I don't. Honestly, you know, when your primary fermentation is over, the mead itself's not going to be generating any more heat. So, you don't have that to worry about. And that's one of the big things, I think, with temperature control is trying to control that heat that's generated from fermentation. But once that's over, I don't give it another thought, honestly. And I never have. And I don't know who's to say that if I did, I might, you know, it might turn out better. I don't know, but I've just never done that. So I say if you can keep it cool, keep it cool. If you can't, don't stress over it.
Well, and if you're in if you've got any kind of forced air conditioning or whatever kind of air conditioning you might have in your home, I did kind of a little experiment, in my house, it is at eye level, the temperature is 70 degrees, anywhere from 70 to 72 degrees, pretty much all the time. In the summertime, it'll go up to about 74. However, at floor level, okay, the temperature is constantly 66 to 67 degrees and no higher. So, cold air sinks, and, you know, that pretty much tells you that, you know, keep your stuff on the ground. Don't put it up on shelves. Take advantage of that cold air that you might have in your house, if you don't have any other method of cooling or, you know, even during fermentation, keep it on the ground. Don't put it up on a shelf or a rack or anything like that. Keep it on the ground. That's where the cooler air is going to be. So,
yeah.
And speaking of coolers, I was just glancing at the Facebook thing here. Patricia Gwen Edwards, she's in the process of building one of these DIY chilling systems, you know, that I built, that we've been talking about for months now. And she's debating some kind of container and something for her chiller design. And I just want to mention the fact that a simple Coleman cooler will do the trick. However, the most important thing that you have to put up with is the ambient temperatures, because when the ambient temperatures rise, that brings the efficiency of your cooler down, especially the Coleman coolers. Now, it's the same thing. I've got a I invested, you know, here again, this was an expense that I had to, I had to work really hard at explaining why I needed a $300 cooler. But this Pelican that I have, it's 2 inches of insulation all the way around, and it has a sealed lid. In other words, it clamps shut. There's a rubber gasket that goes around it. And even on a warm day, if the temperature gets up to 74, 75 in the house, even though it's sitting on the ground, I can go 5 days is the extent of it, okay, with three systems running, with one fermenter and two chiller and two carboy coolers. So keep that in mind. You know, and
well, I had to justify to myself getting a Yeti, but I finally did.
Those are good.
I broke down and got the Yeti.
That works.
It works really well.
Oh yeah,
really well.
That's, you know, if you're really serious about creating this DIY chiller system and really want to get involved with it, that's the route that you should go. You don't have to go that route. Now, there's a simpler way to be able to maximize your efficiency, even with a Coleman cooler, and that's simply to go to Home Depot or Lowe's or, someplace like that and purchase refrigeration foam. Get it a couple of inches thick and, get yourself a saw and cut your pieces to fit inside of a Coleman cooler, or figure out a way that you can wrap the Coleman cooler with it. Cut them to fit so that the Coleman cooler fits inside. That will help it immensely. And you can pick that foam up, relatively. But remember, it's all about efficiency. If you don't want to keep, and if you're buying ice, you don't want to have to keep buying ice every other day. That's how I started out. But, realizing the fact that, God, this is really getting old, I started making my own block ice. And block ice will last a lot longer than cubed ice. And then when I went to the Pelican cooler, I make my own block ice, and my little test one day, and I kept posting this stuff up on Facebook. I went 7 days, okay, and the temperature never got above 40 in 7 days, okay? That's the internal water temperature. I've got a little digital thermometer that has a little probe that goes down into the water inside. So it's all about efficiency, Patricia. Go to Home Depot, Lowe's, look around, see what you can find. You want to insulate your Coleman cooler somehow. Increase the efficiency of that alone will help quite a bit. So anyway.
Yeah, and this goes back to what I said a moment ago. If you're on a budget, or if you're like me and you just hate spending money, this is where you spend your money. Get a good way to control your temperatures and get a good way to bottle your finished product and to keg your finished product. And that's where you spend your money, on the things that count, because the container that you ferment in is not nearly as big a deal as the temperature that it stays at. So, yeah. Think about these things and spend your money wisely. I'm still convinced there's some way I can take some of it with me when I go, so I'm not. I don't like spending it.
Well, and I know how much those Yeti coolers cost too, by the way. So,
yeah, and that hurt. That hurt my feelings when I bought that.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I looked at all the reviews, and you get up into that bracket, and they're pretty much, for the purposes that we're using, You know, some lasted 5 days, some would last 7 days. If I could, I knew that my 5 days was my cutoff. If it was anything less than that, I wasn't interested. Anything more than that, and it had my vote. So there were two or three out there that I was looking at. I settled on the Pelican only because I know Pelican. We carried all of our firearms were carted around in the back of our vehicles in Pelican boxes. They're strong. Hell, you could drop these things out of an airplane and they'll stay together. So I thought, you know what, Pelican, that's a brand that I trust. And so I got it, and I've been completely happy. You know, I ruined the, you know, I mean, within the first hour after it arrived, I already ruined the warranty on it because I was drilling holes in it. So,
yeah, I know. And just to give you an idea on this Yeti, you said you paid $700 for a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about this Yeti. For what I paid for the Yeti cooler, it should vacuum, it should cool, it should cook, clean, and it should mow the lawn.
What size did you get?
I got the big one.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow, dude.
Because I was thinking about future expansion. If I ever get more fermenting buckets, I don't want to be sitting there. I don't want to buy another one. That's for damn sure.
Right.
So it was cheaper to buy the big one than to buy two smaller ones. So I said, let's go ahead and prepare for it now, and it'll handle it if I ever need it to.
Tore me up. So, I had to take the drill to it, and I'm thinking, oh my God, there goes my warranty. But then on the other hand, I mean, who needs a warranty for a cooler anyway? I mean, it's gonna keep things cold.
So. When I paid that much for that cooler and I drilled two holes in it, I had diarrhea for like 3 days.
Yeah.
I mean, it just hurt my feelings so bad. But hey, you know, it works.
I've got two holes. I've got I've got 10 holes in mine.
Yeah. Well, I started out with two, and then if I decide to expand it, I'll have to drill more, but. You know, after that first one, the second one was easier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you're not going to lose any. I mean, you know, the holes, the plastic tubing that I used a half-inch drill bit, and the outside diameter of the tubing that I used to connect the 3/8 to was a perfect half-inch fit, so I'm not losing anything through the holes. The one large hole that the electric cords to the pumps had to go through was a little bit bigger, but I got some of that foam stuff in a can. It's, I don't know what you call it for, you know, you can put it in your walls if you want to. It's that expandable foam stuff. And, I just sealed up the big hole around the, you know, that I had to cut out for the electrical line. So, I mean, it's sealed. It's sealed tight. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is I got mine wrapped up like you wouldn't believe. I mean, I went overboard with insulating all the exits and entrance and everything. I said, to hell with this. If I'm going to pay this much money for it, I'm going to, I mean, you could probably liquefy nitrogen in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how important. Like me, I mean, I spent a lot of money on my fermenters and my system and everything, but that's how important it is to me.
Yeah, we're going to have to stop talking about it because it's making me uncomfortable when I think what I spent on it.
That's funny. But anyway, so yeah, we pretty much reached that point in the show. Good little chat tonight. You know, I kind of like this open end thing. Let's go around the horn real quickly here. The hopper list, Chris, might as well start out with you. You got anything going?
Just got this cherry project that we've got going on the website, and it's been racked out of secondary off the cocoa, and it's sitting clearing. Nothing else so far, but I do have some things on deck. I've got to, like I said last week, I've got to get my my sourwood going, and I've got a couple other melomels I'm going to be working on. I think I'm going to try a few things different, so yeah. We'll get the game plan together over the next few days or weeks, and then get those. I need to get those out of the way because we're going to be getting into fall pretty soon, and that's going to be sizer season. So,
yeah,
I got to get all this routine stuff out of the way that I make every year, so I can jump on the sizers.
Well, you know, and then maybe in the next couple of shows, we should probably start thinking about talking about sizers. That's, you know, like you say, that's coming up. And
yeah, I'd like to get this bracket nailed down and yeah. sort of approach it the same way we did the coffee experiment. And
yep.
We'll look at it as an experiment, and then once we get that under our belt, we should be well into apple season by then. And
yeah.
We can sort of do the same thing with sizers. We can try some different things.
Yep. Aaron, what you got in the hopper list?
Not too much different from last week. Actually, I was just over in the other side of the basement peeking on my hopped meads, and they're definitely getting more and more clear, just about ready to bottle. Other than that, the coffee Beauchet, still pretty cloudy. My sweet... semi-sweet wildflower traditional, also fairly on the cloudy side, starting to show some signs of clarifying though, so right now just kind of playing the waiting game on some of these.
Yeah, well, I've got the peach thing going here. It's kind of in its last few days here. I haven't checked a hydrometer reading on it yet, but I think it's doing fairly well. I keep a pretty close eye on it. This one's happened to be fermenting in a bucket on the floor. It's not in one of my fermenters because of the displacement issue of all the fruit. And I'm pretty happy with it so far. Hoping that it's going to come out the way I like, and you know, anxious to you know, to get that in the bottle and get it, you know, be able to drink it. So besides that, I don't have any other meads going. I'm waiting on some to clear. I've still got the sourwood deal. It's clearing, not real quick, but it's kind of getting there. I dropped some Hungarian oak cubes in it. I'm hoping that's going to add a little mouthfeel, little extra something to it. I really like the way it tastes. Really coming out good. Various wines. I've got three reds and a white wine, a Chardonnay, working. In fact, I'll be putting together a Cabernet tonight with some blackberries and black currants. And then this Braggot thing. Oh, I've got a beer. I actually have a porter. This is a kit that I did. It came out of primary yesterday. It's in secondary, sitting on an ounce and a half of dark roast coffee beans, whole beans, hoping to give it just a hint of a little bit of coffee to it. That's my wife's beer. She loves that kind of stuff. So I'm going to be looking at beer kits, guys, over the next week, and I'm going to make my selection. I'll email you where and what I'm going to pick up. You know, see if we can't get this Braggot thing off the ground. I'm really anxious in doing this. And Chris, you know, bud, I really think I'm going to take you at your word. I think I'm going to head in the direction of the kegerator. I really think that's where I want to go with this. I really, you know, like I need another fermenter, right?
Yeah, and it's going to be so, it's like you said, it's so much easier to sell.
Yeah, it is, really, you know, because my wife, I mean, she, like I said, she loves her beer. She's a real connoisseur when it comes to beer, and so I know that would make her happy. So, but other than that, good show, guys. Might as well wrap it up here. Hopefully Jeff will be able to join us next week, next Tuesday night. You know, I don't even know how many shows. We usually do six and off two, six and off two. I don't even know where we're at.
I think we got through maybe one more week or so, and we came back after 4th of July, so
yeah,
we had two, three, this is probably four. We got maybe two more shows.
Yeah, let's. We'll probably get through this Braggot thing. I want to get that off the ground and get it started. I'm going to put this recipe that Jeff sent us up on the website for a shot. And anybody who's listening to the show, if you do happen to copy the recipe and get, keep us informed. Let us know how you're doing with it. You know, we'd like to hear from you. And, you know, at least, you know, keep track of how you're doing with it and keep us filled in. So with that said, guys, we're going to go ahead and call it a night. Call back next Tuesday night, 9 o'clock, right here at the Mead House, themeadhouse.com. We'll see you then.